Renee and I are assuming that you're here because you're interested in learning to grow through difficulties. And we're not assuming that anything we're going through is anything worse than what you are going through or have gone through or will go through. But we're learning some things, and we've been asked to share those, so here we are. There's so many things you can talk about in this sort of situation. So when Renee and I talked about it, we just landed on really three things that both of us felt like we wanted to talk about. There are a lot of things that we could talk about, but we'll just go with three things. But just to kind of get you into our situation a little bit. Last night I was driving home listening to Avalon, which is one of my favorite bands. And it's one of those times, I listen to their music all the time, but I don't always really pay that close attention to the words, and this one just jumped out at me last night. This song is called When the Time Comes. For every soul, there is a midnight. When it's silent in the room, but loud inside. You lie awake, what seems like forever, and you wrestle with the big stuff that cannot be denied. All of life has led you to this moment. When the time comes and the games are finally over, there's no more pretending. All charades are done. And the time comes when the soul is finally ready to know the truth. And this time you don't run. God is waiting there, you'll find, when the time comes. That really amazingly sums up pretty much everything we have to say today in a song that's worth listening to. You know, I still don't feel like standing up here, so I'm going to do what Renee said, which I should have done to begin with. Yeah. So I'll just put this stuff down here. Okay. Yeah. And as I said, my papers go all over the place. We're going to be talking about our family. So this is an older photograph of our family. I'm going to pass around one copy of a newer photograph. But that one you can keep. And if for some reason you wanted to get in touch with us, later there's contact information on the back of that. And this is a more current photograph of our family with added members that have come along in the last couple of years. We'd like that one back, but before moving to Colorado, looking back at it now, it feels kind of like we lived a charmed life. God gave us 7 beautiful children, and now added 2 more to that, 3 more if you count Lauren, who lives with us. Our ministry over the years in different places we lived, it flourished. And we lived in Virginia, and we were just flush with dear friends all around us, and people that we were ministering to, people that were ministering to us, and all kinds of opportunities. And then God moved us to Colorado to help us to continue to grow in new ways that we didn't expect. And what happened was that move stressed our families, as you would expect, and particularly 2 of our teenagers. Well, lots of things happened right after we moved. But it's kind of like that. The stress of the move boiled some things to the surface that needed to be brought to the surface. So really it was a gift. But so first 3 months, 2 of our children manifested serious eating disorders. Got a call one day from a friend back in Virginia saying, get down to the basement right now because one of your children is trying to take their life. You better get down there. We did. That was 2 months in. A month later, I got a call. I was in an IET meeting. Long, short story of that is that 3 of our children had been molested by someone in the neighborhood. So now we're 3 months into our time in Colorado. Then a few months later, that fall, we got a call from a counselor at school, and just kind of a mysterious call, you need to come in right away. And one of our children was there, and the counselor helped our child to explain to us that years before, this child had been sexually abused by a family member over a period of time. So then we were dealing with that. And then another child, a teenager, started careening down a very self-destructive road. And things, you know, are we having fun yet? sometime later, Renee began having flashbacks to some horrific things that had happened to her as a little girl. And that just really threw all of us, particularly Renee and I, into turmoil like we'd never known. And so, you know, I'd often referred to Renee as Wonder Woman and our children as the seven wonders of the world. But Wonder Woman was coming a part of the scene, and our family was really coming apart at the seams at that time. So, you know, those who have been close to us these last 5 years since we've been here have walked through a lot of this with us. It began to seem like things were settling down. And then Ian, our then 12-year-old, began to manifest some pretty innocuous symptoms, some fevers occasionally. It just seemed like infections that wouldn't go away and some backache and different things. And then we noticed a bruise on his foot that was getting bigger rather than smaller. And that was pretty alarming. That we saw that on a Saturday night and said, okay, we need to take him into the doctor Monday morning. We never made it to that appointment because on Sunday, this was Super Bowl Sunday a year ago, that night Ian developed severe pain and we had to take him to the emergency room. And by noon the next day, we found out that he had cancer. And it wasn't just any cancer. It was a very rare and dangerous form of cancer that kills 95 out of 100 people who get it. Tumor had filled his abdomen. 90% of his bone marrow had been destroyed. And that tumor was doubling in size every 48 hours. So it was moving fast. And it was really a very alarming and dangerous situation. So no wonder his back hurt. So the last 12 months have been interesting. They've been horrible, and they've been wonderful at the same time. This is a photo of Ian with Michael Phelps. You can pass that around. Olympic Training Center is right beside the hospital where we have spent a lot of our time. And so the athletes over there heard about the boy. Did anybody bring any tissues? okay. Pardon? Did you have a question?
No, okay.
Okay.
It's Michael Phelps.
Yeah.
Who I know. Very upset with.
Being a 23-year-old that doesn't know the Lord. But anyway, word got around over at the Olympic Training Center that there's a boy over at the hospital that probably won't live to see the Olympics. So this parade of athletes start coming over to see him. And some relationships have grown out of that, and it's been just amazing. And that's just one story of many amazing things that have happened over this last year. We're convinced that Ian's going to live to be an old man. It just seems that the way the direction God's taking things. His We're dealing with some questions right now, but bone marrow scan shows no cancer now. I'll never forget the first CAT scan after the initial crisis, about 6 weeks in. He had a CAT scan for other reasons because of another crisis going on, but we asked the radiologist about, you know, what was happening with the tumor, and her response was, "What tumor?" Wasn't any tumor there. It was gone.
Very small.
Yeah.
From the entire thing.
Well, I mean, it's small enough that she didn't notice it, and before it was filling his abdomen, so it was pretty significant. But, you know, this is an unfinished story. We're in the middle of it right now. A week ago today, we were in the hospital with Ian. It looked at that time like the cancer had moved into his brain. There were symptoms showing up with that. Now it looks more than likely that's not the case, that probably we're dealing with side effects of chemotherapy. So we're in the middle of a story here, and we had the opportunity to share with you in the middle of that. A lot of times it seems like Christians are willing to talk about things after the story is over with, and they can just smile and tell you how God worked out everything wonderfully. And you could, you know, this is real time. This is like reality television, but we're right here in the middle of it. So you know, on the paper I passed around there, those are the three questions that we'd like to talk about. How are habits of the heart revealed or refined in a crisis? How are one's relationships revealed or refined in a crisis? And how are core beliefs revealed or refined in a crisis? Captain Sullenberger, who landed that aircraft in Hudson River. Everybody's just amazed at this guy.
It's our hometown.
It's your hometown?
Yeah.
All right. And rightfully so. You know, crisis hit. His plane's not going to make it to any airport. We're going down in the Hudson River. And a miracle happens in the Hudson. And, you know, in that situation, I would have screamed, and, you know, we're all going to die, and been pushing in panic buttons all over the place. And but you know, that's not the way he responded. But there's reasons he was able to respond the way he was in the middle of a crisis. I haven't been flying for 40 years. I'm not a graduate of the Air Force Academy. I don't fly gliders on a regular basis. I don't have my own firm that teaches people how to handle this sort of crisis. He was in every way prepared and had practiced and was always prepared for that sort of crisis, and so he was able to handle it. And he's looking around just kind of bewildered. Why is everybody looking at me like a hero? I just did what I've practiced and trained to do in the middle of a crisis. And we can kind of identify with that because some people have kind of treated us like heroes in the middle of this thing. I can't believe how you're handling this and all. You know, we're just putting one foot in front of the other. But one thing we're noticing, just looking back over the last year, is that a lot of our responses this year are based on habits of the heart that have been developed over many years. Someone said about Sullenberger, a friend of his, this was the day after the accident, he said he had rehearsed it, and he had taken it into his heart. He had rehearsed it, and he had taken it into his heart. So he was ready. Kind of root what we're going to share out of the book of Job, but we're just going to touch on it. If you've got your Bible, you can look there if you want. I imagine all of you have read it and are familiar with the story and the highlights of it. But Job had some habits of the heart that are evident right away in chapter 1. He was a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And that says a lot. I mean, not just the point of decision, but all that was true about him and the habits of his life, fearing God and turning away from evil. He had the habit of doing what God led him to do. And then the other thing that's interesting is that he regularly offered blood sacrifices in behalf of his children. And that's interesting when you visualize, you know, cutting the throat of a lamb or something on a regular basis as a blood sacrifice on behalf of your children. And one of the implications of that is you're recognizing that your children don't belong to you. You're constantly buying them back with these blood sacrifices, and that they belong to God. And that became evident, that he had that kind of attitude towards his children pretty quickly, didn't it? The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. One of the habits that we look back on now is even more significant than we realize was the dedication of our children early in their life. Would you like to?
Yeah, each birthday, and we have a lot of them in our house. At one point while we're doing, you know, the dinner and the cake, I will always say to the kids, I want you to remember that when you were 2 to 3 days old, we dedicated you to the Lord, either in the hospital or at home, which was really special. As the older ones could enter in, they remember the last two being a part of the dedication. But I said, I've always said to them, we gave you back to God. You're not just ours. And there will be times as you get older and you leave home, you're going to think you're totally alone. Don't believe it. You don't belong to yourself. Remember that. God's hand is on you.
You could do the math to how many times they've heard that speech with seven kids.
Like, okay, Mom.
Seven birthdays saying. Every year. You know. it's pretty familiar in our house. Well, one thing I do regularly in my time alone with God is offer myself and my wife and my children back to God as a living sacrifice. It's just part of my routine, what I do. And then sometimes God kind of, I don't know if you want to call it, calls your bluff or tests what you say, but, you know, he gives you opportunity to demonstrate whether you mean that or not. Another habit of the heart that has become, that we look back on and realize now how significant it's been for us is journaling. I've often said if anybody ever reads my journals, they're going to think I'm mentally ill. Because I journal, I write a lot more when I'm troubled than when I'm feeling good. You know, so that's where I go, and I just, you know, that's where I'm processing. And journaling has been very significant over this last year. Here's what I wrote February 4th, late at night. All the lights are off in the ICU. I'm sitting there with Ian, pull out my computer and start journaling. I will always remember February 4th as one of the most difficult days of my life, the day that we learned that our 12-year-old, Ian, has cancer. I don't think I've ever cried so much in one day or even in a week. I feel kind of numb. At the same time, I have strong confidence in God's loving care and sovereign control. I'd not say that I'm worried. Each day has enough trouble of its own. I'm just putting one foot in front of the other. I just said that, didn't I? I said that a lot. My prayers are minimal, just breath prayers for the most part, sighs toward God. I know that he's hovering here, watching over us, especially watching over Ian. I imagine that there are angels stationed at the door of the ICU and even in this room. Friends have been wonderful. We are bathed in love and offers of help. Because, of course, what we want most is beyond their human reach. Yet is that healing what we want most? I doubt it. More than anything, I want Ian to know you deeply. I pray that through this, you too will become intimate friends, God and Ian. Help him to learn to pour out his heart to you. Help me to lead him by example. I've prayed regularly that Ian would come to know your Father love through me. May it be so even now. I also pray for miraculous healing. I've experienced that myself in my own body. I've seen it again and again in my sister. Nothing is too difficult for you. It's a matter of asking and trusting, and I do trust you, Lord. I've learned that trusting you does not mean that you will never hurt us, but I trust you anyway, with full confidence that you are truly working for our good. So this habit of journaling, I mean, I'm telling myself the truth here, you know, and processing it, and it's going through me. It's been a vital part for me and subsequently for others as we've shared it with others. What would you say about habits of the heart?
About 15 years ago, we were invited to a conference for Chinese. I don't speak Chinese, but he went to be the speaker. We could understand part of what went on that weekend. But during the weekend, we had the children. And it was, I think it was a Chinese church because it was all ages. And there was one older woman that just caught my attention all weekend. You could tell life had been hard. She was somewhat crippled. But she just glowed. She was radiant. And finally, toward the end of the weekend, I gathered my courage and I went up to her because I didn't even know if she spoke English. And I said, "You are radiant. What is your secret?" And she said, "Surrender." All she said. But it pierced my heart and has stuck there like a barb all these years. And when I'm angry or frustrated or don't like what's been happening in life, I've been trying to learn the posture of surrender. You have the right to do this in our life. And then as one of the things that prepared us, I think, in a lot of ways, we realize now, to deal with this year was the whole process that God unveiled for us through the abuse that I had gone through. We realized that I had been subjected to years of satanic ritual abuse. And it pretty much destroyed my faith and shook David's heart, because the questions were, is God good? Can he be trusted? Because if he's big enough to be good, he could have stopped or prevented all of this. And my trust was shattered. And it pushed me mentally and emotionally to the edge. By his grace, I never totally slipped away. And I can't tell you where, but somewhere in the last 3 years, God met me and began a healing process that, no, he didn't stop it, but he was in the middle of it. And he would show me where he was over and over again. And I know through those memories that he put his hand on me and saved my life when others were not saved. Over and over again, he would put his hand on incidences and say, this far and no farther, that they could not do to me. And he gave me a husband who was willing to hang on and walk me through it, because a lot of men wouldn't do that. So that's not a question that we asked when this happened, because I think we've come to an understand that he's good. He's not safe, but he's good, if you've ever read the Narnia stuff. And then just before, or I guess it was fall a year ago, I heard a teaching from Romans 1:21, and I call it brain rot. But let me read the passage for you, because this has been an absolute cornerstone for me in this last year. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images. And it just shows the downward spiral, which we can see our own culture is spiraling. But where did it start? They refused to see God. They refused to give him thanks. And I thought, I don't want to become blind. I don't want my mind darkened. So the opposite must be true, that if I make a choice to give him glory and thank him, and I've heard this teaching, but it just hit me in a new way, then he's going to enlighten my mind. He is going to let me think his thoughts after him. And that's what I was desperate for. And so I began to do for myself and with my kids. I try every day. I don't do it every day, but what's your God sighting for the day? where have you seen God? And in many days, it's just looking out my kitchen window and seeing Pike's Peak and knowing, okay, God, you've not changed. All hell may be broken here, breaking loose in the house, but you're still the same. By choosing daily to have to give him glory and to thank him, it was building habits of my heart. And some days I've had to look hard. But our thinking then becomes words, and our words become actions, which are based on his kingship and his authority, his right over our life, and over each event, over each long-term consequences that we live with. And without the habit of giving glory and thanks, we cannot be heart-trained to withstand the lies. And the lies will destroy you when your foundations are ripped out from underneath you. Giving glory and thanks focuses and alters the filter on our daily life. So I just look for God sightings on my website. Last night, I don't know if you read it, I just thank God just to meet someone who I didn't even know has been praying for us.
Looking at the second question, how are one's relationships revealed or refined in a crisis? On this one, Job's friends got it right.
For the first 7 days.
And then they got it wrong. But they got it right for the first 7 days anyway. That was a good start. This part I'll just read to you. Just listen and let your imagination work with this a little bit. When Job's three friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, he must have been pretty short, they say, and Zophar the Naamathite, heard about all the troubles that had come upon him, they set out from their homes. So apparently they weren't right next door. They set out from their homes and they met together by agreement. Interesting to think about how that came about. And then to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. So these three guys probably, riding their donkeys or walking or whatever, and they're on their way, and their purpose is to go and sympathize and comfort. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. They began to weep aloud. When our kids or other people, our brothers and sisters, one by one, everybody, all of our family have been out here one time or another over the last year. And the first time they see Ian, it's a little, wow. Hardly recognize him. You saw the contrast in these two pictures. They could hardly recognize him. They began to weep aloud. And they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. I love how expressive the Middle Easterners are. I mean, they just let it loose, just go for it. unlike us, particularly unlike me. Then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights. No one said a word to him because they saw how great his suffering was. So they got it right. Unfortunately, after 7 days, they couldn't keep their mouths shut. And they became very generous with their advice. And the bulk of the book of Job is an argument between Job and his friends. Amazing. So they became less helpful, but they got it right for the first 7 days. All right. For us, this last year has been, it's what's been revealed to us, one of the many things that have been revealed to us is how rich we are with friends, wonderful friends who love us very much. Our first day in the hospital, one of the staff there helped us to set up a Caring Bridge website. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's become pretty popular and so we've used that as a way to keep in touch with a lot of people, and it's just been amazing. The Ian's story kind of went viral. And, you know, we've gotten thousands of personal notes from people. Some of them are repeated, but lots of, and many people we know, some people, quite a few actually, that we don't know. They heard about us through a friend, and the cascading love and faith that has been demonstrated toward us and for us has been really overwhelming and amazing.
Critical for our survival.
Yeah. We began keeping track of the notes that we got from people saying that they're praying for Ian. Not just people that just kind of commented in passing that they're praying for Ian. I mean, and quite a few people would say, I wake up in the morning praying for him, I go to sleep at night praying for him, and he's on my mind all day long. Those kinds of people, I put a dot up on the world map in Ian's ICU unit. And here's a picture of what that map ended up looking like.
It's in his bedroom right now.
Yeah, it's still up in his bedroom. And you can imagine nurses and doctors coming through. What's that? You know, just it's amazing testimony to the body of Christ working together. And, you know, that's kind of on the macro scale. On the this more intimate scale, so many, I mean, we couldn't tell you all the stories. One that comes to my mind was, you know, we're a few weeks into this thing, and there's one day when it just hit me. You know, you just kind of go through stuff, and you're just putting one foot in front of the other. And our oncologist had gotten sick, so his nurse practitioner was there the day that we got the final diagnosis and came to understanding. And we love her, but she's not used to breaking that kind of news to people. And the way she broke it to me, it was just so obvious she was scared for us. And it hit me. And so I made a mistake of going online and Googling alveolar rhabdomyosarcoma and seeing the statistics. And, you know, I just was overwhelmed. And I called a friend, a dear friend, and said, come now. And he did. He was there within an hour. And anyway, he came, and I managed to get the door shut on his car before I started wailing, you know. We drove around, and he cried with me. And, you know, eventually I settled down. We were able to talk through some things. But the people who were there for us in the middle of the night, different times, it's just, it was amazing. All these stories are flashing from my mind, but I'm going to move on because there would be too many of them. Now, my sister Linda, this is the backstory to this whole thing. We've been walking with my sister Linda for 8 years. She's been living with cancer. And she's an amazing story in and of herself with many miracles along the way. But God's given her a ministry with people in pain. And she told me not too long ago about a woman who came to her, woman in their church, wife of one of the elders in the church, who found out that she might have breast cancer. And she came to Linda very hush-hush and said, you know, I'm only talking to you, basically. Nobody else knows. And wanted her to keep it a secret and all this. And I thought, it's so sad. You know, she's part of a body that is intended to hurt with her and comfort her and carry her along by their faith. And yet she was fiercely keeping it secret and not allowing other people to be a part of that with her and carry her along. That's not the way God intended it. And we've decided over the years, it's just become a habit for us to kind of live our lives out loud. The good, the bad, and the ugly. We're going to share it with people so we can walk together through life.
He made that choice.
Yeah. And, you know, that way everyone benefits. They get to share in the joys, real joys, and they also get to help carry the sorrows. So what would you say about how about our relationships have been refined and revealed in this time?
Mine is maybe just a little bit more practical. Just never underestimate a kind word or a kind action. I think of how many times I've said, I'll pray, and I really meant it. But it can be that thing that that day someone just hangs on to. I believed people when they said to me that they would pray. It might be just only as they walked away from the conversation. But I trusted in that. I was grateful for it anyway. And people were praying for us every day. Just so humbling. Even this past weekend, as things were breaking loose again with Ian, a man said to us, I woke up all through the night, Friday night, praying for you. And I thought, I'm so sorry you couldn't sleep, but thank you. That concern that's communicated infuses God's strength. It's just how he does it. I learned how practical details can help you get through just living and surviving, because Ian was in the hospital for an extended time in crises, and we have a little one at home still, and running errands. Someone else took over scheduling meals, because it's almost impossible to do that for yourself. Another friend who went to restaurants and enlisted them and was bringing in meals for weeks. The kids thought that was really cool. Mm-hmm. Taking our youngest Graham to play or go to a movie, a basket of fruit or munchies in the hospital room because it's just so hard to get out. Sometimes it would be 2 o'clock in the afternoon and he had never even gone out of the room because he stayed 24/7.
Just jump in here. A friend, Diane, we arranged basically call forwarding, so all calls went to her. And I had another phone that people who were close could get in touch with me, but even to that degree.
Yeah. Stopping by for just a couple of minutes for a hug or a prayer. Going and buying pajamas for Ian. He didn't have stuff that fit him. Transporting laundry back and forth. Sometimes driving me back home, and I was so exhausted. They were afraid to put me behind a wheel. Just the communicating via email or the caring bridge. But there are some things I would say do not do, and I'm sure you all can identify with this. Don't say to someone, well, call me if you need help. They will not call. Either it's humbling, it's humiliating to call. It's just hard to impose on people. Don't preach. Don't promise healing. God hasn't promised it. Don't say, oh, it'll all work out. This may not make sense, but don't be saccharine in your answers. I guess it's the same thing of, oh, God works all things out for good. That's nice. Don't say you understand unless you really do. Don't think you have to give answers. Just be there. Don't be afraid of tears. Just hand the box Kleenex over. Don't be afraid to hug. Don't tell other horror stories. Some people just don't know what to say, but they start telling other things, and you're barely sitting up anyway. Do touch family members or the patient. If the patient, sometimes all they get is people poking and taking blood pressure or whatever. Touch is healing. And do be sensitive to the timing for the patient's needs. You know, sometimes people came and it was just crises after crises with Ian, and we couldn't even go out in the hall and say hi. I thought, oh, they don't get upset that they came all the way down here. But those are just a few practical things.
Would you like to read that from Linda?
In the midst of some of the worst of her times, Linda wrote, I remember a dream from 7.5 years ago. I was on my back, but moving along. Not under my own power, but as though weightless. Looking over my shoulder, I could see many, many people. They were underneath me, holding me aloft over their heads, with their uplifted hands and arms. It was almost like a celebration. They were singing and praising God as they carried me across an empty hill. the same hill where our little church now stands. My feet could not touch the ground. There was no need. I relaxed. They did all the work for me, and I was able to rest knowing they would never let me fall. And when I woke, I was filled with peace. It turns out it wasn't a dream after all. The saints who'd been praying for me were those people who carried me. Now they're the same ones who praise him for the work he's done in me. And that's really what it's like. There have been times like David, it's like you don't know where you are, and you look down and you realize it's this picture of there's these massive white wings underneath us. Somebody's carrying us.
Yeah. When people have asked, how are you doing? Which is a question you sometimes came to hate because you really don't want to have to explain how you're doing. But what I usually say, and it's the way I feel, is we're just being carried along. But you know, that doesn't happen unless we live our lives out loud and allow people to share with us. I heard about a man in the midst of this who was going through cancer. No family, no friends. The hospital couldn't send him home because there was no one who could help him at home. So he suffered alone. Perhaps he died alone. I don't know. It's not what God intended for any human being. And I mean, we've been studying Africa, you know, and in Africa, I'm told that the worst thing you could do to a person is leave them alone. If you go and visit an African home, I don't know if you've experienced this or, but I heard about a friend who was staying with an African family, and they, the family had previous plans to go somewhere, so they went and found an old man off the street and brought him in and had him stay there so that this person would not be alone while they were gone. Is this consistent? Yeah. And that's biblical. And godly, we're not meant to handle things alone. And relationships grow through these times and deepen as they ought to. So, and then the third question is, how are core beliefs revealed or refined in a crisis? Back to Job. As Job's drama unfolded, that's what happened. His core beliefs came out. Some of them were good, some of them weren't. I've never quite figured this thing out. You know, God describes him as blameless and upright, and he never sinned. But some of the things he said as he went along, you kind of think, I don't know, you know. So, you know, early on he said, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. I will hope in him. That's it.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, Job's trust in God, you know, though he slay me, yet I will hope in him. I mean, that's a huge statement, and it's from deep in his soul he was saying that. And those sorts of core beliefs are brought out into the open and tested and strengthened and developed through these sorts of times. But some other things came out. And later in the book, it says Job's three friends stopped answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. And these sorts of things do tend to humble us. And, you know, Job went through that, didn't he? And later, Job said, my ears, this is when God confronts him and kind of dresses him down, you know. And Job's response was, my ears had heard of you. I'd heard all about you, God. You know, I knew all these facts and stories other people had told, but now my eyes have seen you. And I think that one of the things that happens in these times is we begin to get to know God the way he really is. Maybe not the way we wished he was, but the way he really is. Things get stripped down. So our core beliefs get revealed and refined in a crisis. And I'd like to reflect on three core beliefs, three questions, three core beliefs that have been tested and developed in us over this last year. And the three are, just so you don't miss them, they're simple. Pain is a gift. Secondly, pain weans us from self-sufficiency. And then third, pain develops seasoned trust. So pain is a gift. Pain weans us from self-sufficiency, and pain develops seasoned trust. So what I have here is I'm going to share some more from my journals. And you know, but with each of these, I'm thinking that probably you all have some insights as well, and I know Renee does. So feel free to interrupt me. And, you know, sort of apologize for reading to you, but I'm letting you into the inner sanctum of my heart and just sharing. Because this is where my heart comes out. I'm an introvert, all right? So you get the inside look here, all right? Yes, please.
Do you feel like the pain could be emotional
or psychological as well as
physical?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when we're talking about pain, I mean, this last year with Ian's cancer, actually, I don't feel like it's been the hardest thing we've gone through in the last 5 years. I really don't. It's not the way I've experienced it. It has been hard, been very hard. But you know, for example, you know, Renee talked about learning to believe, is God really good? And the questions we were dealing with before the cancer pushed us to the wall on that question. Is God really good? Why didn't he prevent this, these things in the past when he could have? Little girl, you know. and we, you know, we kind of went to the mat on that. So when people, I mean, within days, probably within hours of when this thing hit, the cancer hit, people were saying to us, basically, aren't you wrestling with why would God allow that to happen to your family and to that boy of all people? You know, that question wasn't there because we'd already settled that one. You know, so it's a kind of a whole package that we're looking at over the last 5 years. You know, and most of it really is emotional. So pain is a gift. my chiropractor once said to me, David, are you a military veteran? You have such a high pain tolerance. But I think, actually, I'm a wimp when it comes to physical pain. I've never had a broken bone. I've never had a serious illness. And I've never experienced childbirth. In fact, I passed out while just watching. So, you know, I'm pretty much a wimp on these things. But I believe that there is no pain like watching your child suffer and not being able to make it stop. That's how they break the tough guys in the movies. You know, you can torture me all you want, but you bring in somebody I love and start to mistreat them and everything comes out. The hero resists all kinds of torture until they bring in someone precious to him and threaten to inflict pain on the one he loves, and the hero caves in. I can only imagine the pain my Ian was experiencing when that tumor pressing on his organs with unrelenting force. Drugs helped, but one day, even heavy narcotics didn't seem to dull the pain of having a tube the size of my little finger inserted through his side between his ribs to drain fluids. By the time the tube was inserted, I'd been at Ian's side 24/7 in an ICU for over 2 weeks. taking a graduate course on pain. That night, the night after this particular procedure, I wrote, "These last 2 weeks have shown me more about pain than I ever wanted to know. For the most part, I've been learning vicariously through Ian. He has shown courage. He's endured well, and I'm very proud of him." And my daughter calls. Pain is a gift. Renee has a book entitled Pain, The Gift Nobody Wants. It's written by a physician explaining the value of pain. How we'd be in deep trouble without this God-given warning system. What if Ian had felt...
Take it, please, because it's...
This is my 21-year-old daughter living in Virginia.
She's self-sufficient.
Yeah.
She's good with her 16-year-old brother.
Yeah, she is. Okay, what if Ian had felt no searing back pain that took us to the ER? The lethal tumor would still be growing unchecked. So now she's calling Mom. In fact, by now, he'd probably be dead. So back to this. Pain increases our capacity. When I was searching for God as a teen, I read a Lebanese mystic named Khalil Gibran. I remember that he said that pain is the tool that God uses to carve out the crucible of our hearts so that they have a greater capacity for joy. It's clear to me that this experience is developing depth in Ian beyond his years. I'm sure that he'll come through this with a new appreciation of simple pleasures and a new ability to sympathize with others, and he's developing a refined understanding of what's really important, especially for a 12-year-old. Pain brings us together. Picture every member of your body responding to your fingers caught in a slammed door, your voice box screaming, your face grimacing, your knees buckling, your mind working out solution, in the other hand, trying frantically to help. This is a remarkable picture of how the body of Christ around the world has been responding to Ian's pain and to our pain. As I watch Ian suffering, I think of our Heavenly Father watching the agony of his son on the cross. Surely his father's heart writhed in agony. Surely he wanted to stop his son's pain. When Ian winces and cries out, I leap out of sleep and do everything in my power to stop it. And often there's little I can do. What courage and love for us, the Father in heaven, showed in withholding his angels, restraining his power, and allowing his son to suffer for us. My view of the cross is forever changed. For years I've been preaching my life message from 2 Corinthians 4:7 through 12. This is the passage Mike Shamey shared with us yesterday over lunch. I've preached how God uses difficulties to lead us out of our petty preoccupation with ourselves and into experiencing his life with a capital L. Although I've suffered some, in my heart of hearts I've sensed that more intense suffering was coming our way. And now it has arrived. Now we're taking the test. Now we'll see if all I've said is really true. Well-designed tests reveal what really is in us. This isn't merely theory or theology anymore. So, yeah. Pain is a gift. Do you all have any thoughts on that before I go on to the next one? 2 Corinthians 4, 7 through 12. It says, we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not abandoned. Struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry about in our body the death of Jesus so that, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that his life may be revealed in our body, in our mortal body. So then, death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. This is pain weans us from our self-sufficiency. I call this oxygen. This little reading. Sometimes God presses the eject button on our comfortable lives, suddenly launching us from our cozy routines and hurling us out into thin air. I think of that guy that ejected out of the plane that went down near San Diego just before it hit the ground. My family and I were cruising along through everyday school and work and meetings and church. Then bang, the canopy exploded and we were hurled out into a pediatric intensive care unit. It all came so fast and we barely had time to breathe. Late one night, after 2 days of nonstop life-threatening crises, I sat down beside Ian's bed to write in my journal. That's what I wrote. If there's any sense of putting our confidence in anything but God here, that confidence has been pushed aside by harsh realities. Yet God does not deal in probabilities. God does not probably work for our good. God is not probably going to succeed in whatever he chooses to do. God always works for our good and never fails. Yet our emotions are caught in the sometimes frightening intersection of faith and living in a broken world. So we pray and cling to the one who transcends all of this. In writing that, I was putting on my oxygen mask. You know the routine. Every time the flight attendant briefs us, just in case. How often have I dozed through those safety briefings? But this is no drill. My son could really die. And I desperately need to access the oxygen of what Jesus called my peace and grace and wisdom. A few nights later, after that first writing in the ICU at 3 a.m., I awoke to the sound of an alarm. Ian's oxygen mask had slipped off, and his oxygen level had dropped dangerously low. I replaced the mask, and he recovered quickly. Each of us needs extra oxygen when we are either weakened by sickness or exercising hard or at a high altitude where there's little oxygen available, like up on Pike's Peak, which I could see from the ICU window. During those weeks in the ICU, I found myself in need of extra spiritual oxygen. I was weakened by the impact of Ian's sickness and the sicknesses afflicting my wife and other children. The week that he went into the hospital, Renee and everybody else in the family got the flu except me, so they couldn't even come into the hospital. I was working hard at serving Ian and others and climbing a steep medical learning curve, and I was living in extraordinary circumstances where the air was thin. I was grateful for extra oxygen through notes, visits, and practical support from those who love us, through the personal presence and touch of my father. I was learning to breathe deeply. I was learning to breathe the supernatural air that I was designed to breathe. Let me say that again. I was learning to breathe the supernatural air that I was designed to breathe. I was learning to be carried along by grace in new ways I had not known. We can live for weeks without food. We can live for days without water. We can only live for minutes without oxygen. We're designed to take in fresh oxygen all the time. Without it, we die. We were also designed to abide in Christ so completely that apart from him, we can do nothing, not even for a few minutes. But we learn otherwise. So occasionally we need a little shock therapy. There's something deep within us that resists living in moment-by-moment dependence on God. We fight it hard. I remember a compelling scene in the movie The Abyss that illustrates how desperately we resist this. The entire film takes place deep underwater. The survival of the underwater crew depends on the captain diving deeper than conventional equipment will allow. He has to use experimental equipment that enables him to breathe liquid oxygen to equalize his system. The camera zooms in on his face as his helmet fills with liquid. His comrade assures him, "It's going to be okay. Remember, you breathed liquid for 9 months in your mother's womb." That makes some sense, but you can see the terror on his face as he inhales the liquid, literally drowning himself to survive. For a moment, he convulses violently because it's so unnatural. Then he recovers and begins breathing the liquid and signals through a computer with a keyboard, "This is weird. You should try it." That's what it feels like to relinquish control. Enter into moment-by-moment surrender and dependence on God. It can feel like dying. No wonder God has to force our hand. So the idea is that pain and suffering force us into living the way we're supposed to live. To live by grace in ways that we somehow strangely resist doing under other circumstances. Pain develops seasoned trust. Yesterday I was reminded that it seems important to many to say that God would never hurt us. Think about that. It seems important to many Christians to say that God would never hurt us. That line of thinking concerns me deeply because it sets up people to become disillusioned with God, or with those who teach such things. It also concerns me because it requires disregarding so much of how God reveals himself in the scriptures. And it touches in an open nerve for me as we walk through painful circumstances with our son. Has God forgotten us? Is God mad at us? I don't think so. This brings me back to something that has become more and more precious to me. I call it seasoned trust. Naive trust says, God will always work out things the way I want them to be. Notice the big I in that sentence. Seasoned trust says, God might hurt me, but I trust him anyway. Why would I trust him anyway? I've seen so much of his love and goodness in the scriptures and in my life, so the torrents of pain have to flow around those immovable rocks. Trust is the cord that keeps me lashed to the mast as the hurricane seems to be tearing everything else away from its moorings. Trust enables me to trust the way of God's decisions. Trust keeps hope alive and even eager as it waits. Trust nurtures and protects one's memory of what is true and right. Trust protects one's longing for God when it might have been extinguished. Trust strengthens one's spirit to keep looking for God when he seems so far away. Will God hurt me? Sometimes. But only out of love and wisdom. A dear friend calls him the blessed controller of all things. She has often said, God is too loving to be unkind and too wise to make any mistakes. I'd add that he is too powerful to miss any detail or to let anything get past his sovereign control. And right now that friend is suffering in a nursing home with dementia. I hope that she can remember this truth until the end. She is living on the ragged edge of faith. So we're right on the end of our time. I just want to leave those three questions with you. I mean, we've shared what we're learning, but those three questions are worth chewing on in your own time alone with God. If you just take those and sometime in the coming weeks, just take those questions to God yourself and find the answers that God's giving you to those three questions. What are the habits of the heart, or how are habits of the heart revealed in a time of crisis? how are relationships revealed or refined in a time of crisis, and how are core beliefs revealed or refined in a crisis? Thanks for letting us share.